Appreciate that devotional and a number of the things that have come out through the service thus far. Those that live and enjoy darkness today will get to experience it forever. Those that live in the light today and enjoy the light get to enjoy that forevermore. Which is your choice? Welcome to the visitors that are here. Trust that you will be blessed being here and strengthened and encouraged as we share together here this morning. About a week and a half ago, our family was to a viewing. Older man in our community here, some of you would know him. 83-year-old man, went to sleep on Friday evening, never woke up. He was a father of 15 children, 108 grandchildren, and 52 great-grandchildren. A lot of descendants. And then over the last weekend, my wife and I were out to Missouri to the viewing and funeral out there for Corrine Allgaier, a mother of 38 years old, mother to five children. And both of these services that we were at were attended by large numbers of people waiting in long lines to be there. Why? Well, as I thought about that and as I pondered this somewhat, what some of the lessons are from these two individuals that died. What are the lessons for me? What do I need to consider? What do I need to learn? Each of those two individuals touched a lot of lives. Evidenced by the amount of people that were there. There were a lot of people there. They touched a lot of lives. And those lives that were touched came to pay their respects, came to share in the sadness of the moment. But the legacy of these two individuals' lives go on. Yes, they died. Their bodies were put in the ground. But the results of their life continues to go forward. There was a positive influence that came out of both of their lives. Interestingly enough, the older man, Robert Zimmerman, some of you would know him. I probably knew him better than Corrine Allgaier. Would have grown up going to the same church together. In some ways, I feel like I know him more. And I know he wasn't a perfect man. Nobody is. But there was a positive influence that came out of his life. The legacy of their lives will go on in their mistakes and failures. And the lessons that can be learned from those that are close to them. The legacy will go on in the memory of those lives that they touched in a positive way. Their legacy will go on in their descendants, the children and grandchildren, great, 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 however many there is till Jesus comes. That will continue. Their decisions, their lives are going to be touched by the decisions and choices made by these individuals that passed away. And of course, not just those two, but every single one of us here. The legacy of our lives will go on. It will go on based on how we lived, what our choices were, what our decisions were. Maybe you think on a beautiful Sunday morning like this that death is rather a morbid subject to be looking at. And maybe it is, but that's a little bit what the focus of the message is this morning. But I don't think it necessarily needs to be a morbid subject. Maybe a little bit more on that later. Actually, this is probably tied in with it quite closely as well. As I consider that, why death is such a morbid subject, and why we tend to shrink from death, and why we don't, we go to viewings and funerals because we feel somewhat obligated, in part. It's not something I enjoy going to. I doubt if very many here do either. it's a change. And I guess the older I get, the more I dislike change, the more I resist change. Maybe that's just not something with age, but yet I think it can be. Another thing that we humans like, we like changes. If there's going to be changes, we like changes with options. And one of those options is maybe to return back if we don't like the change, whatever it may be, whether it's building a house, whether it's changed in jobs, we like to have options. Death does not bring any options along with it to return back. It's a change that's permanent that we really have very little control over. And the reason I say very little control is because we can be careless with our lives, we can be careless with other people's lives. So in that sense, we can control death to a point. But yet God is in ultimate control of our lives and of our death. Few have returned from death. Scripture records a number of instances where those that died passed on and returned back to life. Lazarus was one. After Jesus' death, it says many of the saints arose and came out of the graves. Few have returned from death. And so it's an unknown. We don't like unknowns. It goes along with the idea of the options. We like to know what. So if we don't like something, we can change and correct it. But death is something that's outside that. Few have returned from that. Yes, you can read stories of people that in modern times here that claim to have died and claim to have returned to life. I'm very inherently skeptical of a lot of those stories because they appear to be mostly a claim to fame and money. But yet I do believe that death is something that people have returned from, but I prefer to stick with scriptural accounts because those I believe. But people we've learned to depend on that are suddenly snatched out of our lives, outside of our control, is just not something that we enjoy and look forward to. It's not a pleasant subject. It's not a pleasant thing. And we do not adjust to those changes very well. Those of us that live have to pick up the pieces of this permanent change and go on. And it's not easy. At death, a soul is moved from a temporal state on this earth to a permanent state on the other side. Where is that destination? Where will yours be? The title of the message this morning is Where the Tree Falleth, There It Shall Be. Taken from Ecclesiastes chapter 11. You can turn to that. We'll be spending a good bit of time in the book of Ecclesiastes this morning. In some ways, it's a continuation of our Sunday school lesson. As we looked at Solomon and his choices and his decisions, and he made a lot of poor ones, resulting in a son that made some more poor ones, some more bad decisions. But it is interesting, and the book of Ecclesiastes is very interesting because it's written from the viewpoint of an older man, Solomon. Well, let me back up here a little bit. The book of Ecclesiastes does not specifically say that Solomon was the author. The only name given to the author is the preacher. But it's pretty obvious from numerous references, and especially in chapter 1, who this author is. Chapter 1, verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Okay, there's a clue. This is the son of David that's writing this. Verse 12, the preacher was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Okay, so now we have a son of David who's king. Now, sometimes a son of David was not. Scripture uses that in terms of a grandson or a great-grandson or some of the descendants of David, the son of David. But we have another one again in verse 16, and he mentions, I am come to great estate and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Solomon was given to wisdom, greater than any before him. So I do believe that this was written by Solomon, even though it is not expressly stated. I think there's enough of clues, enough of indications throughout the book that Solomon was the author. But it's written on the perspective of Solomon, looking back in the older years of his life. Looking back over his life, what can I learn? What did I see? Where were my mistakes? And I'm thankful that he took the time to write these down for us to look at and consider. There's youth amongst us this morning. The book of Ecclesiastes is an excellent one to study. And not just young folks, but really all of us. But it helps you to give you, I think, a valuable perspective of life. At your age, and it doesn't seem like that long ago when I was sitting where you're sitting now, life looks pretty open, looks pretty long, looks pretty far out there. The concept of old age is so far, and it's hard to even really grasp. And for me, it is still too as well, somewhat. But consider your life. Consider the direction of your life. Here's a man looking back on it, and he has a lot of regrets. He has a lot of regrets on how he lived his life. He looks back over chapter 2 over all the material things that he acquired and what he did with them. I think I'll just take the time to read a couple verses here. Chapter 2, verse 3. I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under heaven all the days of their life. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water, to water therewith the wood that brings forth trees. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold, and the peculiar treasure of kings and of provinces. I got me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. So I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was the portion of all my labor. What did Solomon not have after all that? He had literally everything that a man could want or wish for, did he not, in the material sense? Verse 9, I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem, more than so than King David. Verse 8, he mentions silver and gold and music, servants, people to wait on him and give him, do everything he needed done. He didn't have to do it. Vineyards and works in verse 4, 5, and 6. So what did Solomon not have? This great man looked back on this period with regret. Verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. It brought him vexation of spirit. Didn't bring happiness. Didn't bring comfort. Didn't bring joy. It brought him vexation. Are we any different? Are you and I any different here? In this time we live in the country that we live in, we still have this thought that money brings happiness, possessions bring happiness. Well, what did Solomon learn is that he reflected on throughout the book of Ecclesiastes? What was the purpose of him writing it? Well, one of them is the one we just looked at. The pursuit of pleasure and possessions do not bring happiness. Chapter 4, verse 6, he says this, "Better is a hand full with quietness than both the hands full with travail and vexation of spirit." And that's what he had. So this was his testimony to somebody that had it all. It would be better to have little in quietness. I thought that was interesting. Probably his life was full of stuff, of things happening. And he thought a quietness would be a blessing. Maybe that's a lesson we need to work at learning as well. The quietness at home, quietness in our sphere is okay. It's a blessing. Chapter 2, verse 14. "I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit." I'm sorry, that's chapter 1. I wanted chapter 2, verse 14. "The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all." There's one event that's going to hit every single one of you, and myself, unless Christ returns first, and that is death. Death will come upon us all. All must die, the wise man and the foolish man, both. And they both die the same. Verse 15, "Since said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart that this is also vanity. For there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever. Seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? The same as the fool." All will die, and they will both die the same. Both will be put in the ground. All of Solomon's wisdom and all his possessions and all his might and all his influence couldn't hold off death. And at his old age, he finally realized that as he looked back over his life and he realized that he was temporal. He was dispensable, just like everyone else. Chapter 9, verse 12. Continuing with our thought here. "For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falleth suddenly upon them." We do not know when death will come. It comes to young and old. And it was interesting for me to consider that, the difference in atmosphere between the two different viewings that we were to. The older man that died, it was sudden, yes, but yet it was somewhat expected. At the age of 83, you know, your time on this earth is limited. We know that a person at that age, death is coming soon in most cases. How about a 38-year-old mother? Where was the indication that her time was soon up? Man knoweth not his time, but God does. Chapter 2, verse 24. Thinking of death, thinking of our lives, preparing for death. "There is nothing better for a man that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God." Our work, our labors, our eating and drinking is for God's honor and for his glory. And apart from that, it is of no value or very little value. Our work is of little value apart from God. Chapter 5, verse 8. And I'm only touching through a few of the ones, of the many throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Chapter 5, verse 8. If thou seest the oppression of the poor, and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter, for he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. God sees injustice and oppression. Do not think that what you do is unnoticed. God sees, and God sees the oppression of the poor and the perversion of judgment and justice. Are we unjust at times? Yes, we are. Do we oppress the poor? I don't know, do we? I haven't given a lot of thought to that question. I'll leave it for you to consider. Is there a way we oppress the poor? But whether we do, whether we not, God sees it. God sees injustice. And God will recompense in his time. Chapter 8, verse 16. When I applied mine heart to know wisdom, and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes, Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. We cannot understand or comprehend God's ways. And Solomon realized that. In all his wisdom, he beheld the work of God, and he couldn't understand it. Though a man labor to seek it out, yet shall he not find it. There are things of God, and God's working in our lives, that we do not understand. More of that later. Chapter 3, verse 17. One more yet. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. Solomon realized that after death comes judgment. After death comes judgment. We will all stand someday before the judgment seat of Christ, of God. We will all be there. God will judge. After death comes judgment. And many, many more throughout the book, but these are just a few that connected well with the message this morning. I want to give you strong encouragement for you to take the time to read through the book of Ecclesiastes. And no matter what age you are, there's a lot of truths in here. This man, Solomon, learned a lot of things, and he learned them the hard way. May we take some lessons from that. From his life, from the things he learned. Getting into the message here a little bit more, I have four main points that I'd like to look at as we consider this subject. First one is all of life is a preparation for death. And again, you may think, oh, what a morbid subject. But really, that's what it's all about, is it not? We live our lives in preparation from death. It's been said as soon as someone is a new life is born, it is on its way to death. So life is a preparation for death. We will all die, as Solomon declared here. All will die. You and I both. You know, most of America in our society today does not like to consider the reality of death. You go to most funerals, if they even have a graveside service. It's been a little bit more of a common thing, I think, today to do this celebration of life in replacement of a funeral that's somewhat of supposed to be a joyful occasion, and I've been to a few of those and some of my relatives. And then there's the graveside, the burial just sort of happens. I think they maybe still do that with some services, but they may not even do that anymore. But America today does not like to deal with the reality of death. If you go to most society, if they have a graveside service, it's very different from ours. The body will usually not be put in the ground until after the service is over and everybody's left. Everybody has gone. I remember as a boy going to one of our relatives, and I was disappointed that we didn't get to see the conclusion of it. But America does not want to consider that. And I appreciated how we go the whole way with our graveside services. The body is put in the ground, the lid is lowered, the dirt shoveled on, and I think that's something that's been done more in recent times. As growing up as a boy, I don't remember seeing that we actually, the grave was actually totally filled in. I think that's something that has changed more recent years, and I appreciate that fact. It's final. Death is final. And I think that whole service is a recognition of the finality and the permanency of death. All of life is a preparation for death. The sin problem is a critical thing in this preparation for death. Sin destroyed God's perfect world. Sin entered the Garden of Eden and affected the lives of Adam and Eve. And we bear the consequences of their choices and our choices today yet as well. Wherefore, Romans 5:12, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. You and I both have a sin problem, every single one of us. And it continues to trouble the world that you and I inhabit. It affects us day in and day out. It's on the billboards as we drive down the street. It's in the news when you read the news. It's in literature that you pick up. It comes in our mailboxes. It's literally thrown in our faces. It's all around us. Society seems to revel in it. And they look at us and think, what's wrong? Why don't you run with us to the same excessive riot? Sin is thrown in our faces day after day, week after week. It creeps into our thoughts, invades our attitudes and motives, and eventually guides our decisions and our actions if we allow it to continue its deadly work. We have a sin problem, every single one of us. And yes, we can look back to Adam and Eve and blame them for their decision. But yet, God created each of us a free moral agent to choose between right and wrong. Just as Adam and Eve had to choose between right and wrong, you and I have to choose between right and wrong. And how do we stack up against them? No better. We have a sin problem. 1 Timothy 5:24, let's turn to that one. Keep your finger in Ecclesiastes because we're going to be coming back to that. But 1 Timothy 5:21. I'm sorry, 24. 1 Timothy 5:24. Some men's sins are open beforehand, going before to judgment. And some men they follow after. What's the difference? Why do some men's sins go before and some men's sins follow after? Repentant sin goes before and is cleared. Some men go to judgment and their sin follows after. That was a challenging verse to consider. Where are your sins? Have they gone on before? Or are they still with you and still following after behind you because they've been unresolved and untaken care of, unrepented of, unconfessed? Are your sins going before? Are they being cleansed and washed away? Or are they still part of your life and still continuing to affect you? Unrepented sin will deny us entrance to heaven. Verse 25, likewise also the good works of some are manifest beforehand, and they that are otherwise cannot be hid. Ephesians 5, 14 to 16. Wherefore he saith, Awake thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. There's a reference to light that we heard about in the devotional meditation. See then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. We do live in evil times, in evil days. Consider that. Therefore, we need to walk circumspectly. Carefully, that word circumspectly means in a circle, or looking in a circle, looking all around, looking behind us, looking beside us, looking in front of us. Let's be aware, be open, be wise. And Christ shall give thee light as we try to see what lies around us, the darkness that's in around us, understanding the darkness. The light of Christ will help us sort through those things. God is calling you and me to a life of holiness. We are called to a life of holiness. We are called to walk closely to Him. God wants us close. And I think as we walk close to God, as we walk in His light, it makes what's around us, makes our circumspect walk so much clearer. How is your walk this morning? Are you walking with God? Are you walking close to God? Are you walking close enough to be my brother and sister? Close enough to be a help to me? God is looking for fruit from us. John the Baptist said this in Matthew chapter 3, verse 10, And now also the axe is laid unto the root of the tree. Therefore, every tree which bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. God is looking for fruit. God is looking for results from our lives. 2 Corinthians 5, we should turn to that one as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Wherefore we labor that whether present or absent, we may be accepted of him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that every one may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. There is a reckoning for our lives, and it's based on what we have done, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, whether it is good or bad. The choices you make today will affect you. We will be judged by them. I see the clock is continue going. I need to keep moving here. Moses chose rather to suffer affliction than to enjoy the pleasures of sin, which are fleeting and short-lived. If we can live in sin, we will die in sin. But if through Jesus we live in life and light, then we will also reign with him. As the tree falleth, there shall it be. That permanent change we cannot alter. Number two, the vanity of riches. Solomon mentioned that. I already read the verse in chapter 2:11. I won't read it again. He looked upon all that he had, and it was vanity and vexation of spirit. So the richest man in the world today, according to Forbes, is Jeff Bezos. He's worth $113 billion. I wrote million down here. Has he learned the vanity of riches? Have we learned it? Do we look on him with a little bit of envy, wishing we had what he does? Well, Solomon had more than that, at least in his day. He had more power, more influence, more wisdom, more wealth, and he said it's not worth it. To our text verse, in verse 11, which I failed to mention earlier, verse 3, If the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth, and if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. It's final. The two verses preceding that, Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. What's he saying here? This rich man, this wealthy man, what's he saying in these two verses? What's he trying to tell us? Cast your bread upon the waters. It almost sounds like a careless just throwing out of money and wealth and giving. I think there's a verse that mentions to be a giver that's almost like a hilarious giver. I can't get the verse together in my mind, but it kind of carries this same thought through. God has given us many things. God has given us much wealth. What are we doing with it? Is it being kept to me, or is it being thrown out? And verse 11 says, cast it out upon the waters. And what's going to happen to it? Thou shalt find it after many days. It's going to come back. Give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Our riches are to be used to benefit others, to bless other people. And in so doing, they actually come back on us. They actually can bless us. You know, it's interesting to consider that a selfish man will keep as much as he can in case of bad times. What this verse is saying is get rid of it so you're ready for when bad time comes. And that's a foreign thought for how we tend to think. We want to keep it here just in case. But he's saying get rid of it just in case. I'd like to take the time to read a story here that illustrates this point very well. In the early decades of the 20th century, Aaron Rempel, a wealthy Mennonite farmer and estate owner, lived in southern Russia in a town called Nordenfeld. He was so prominent and wealthy, and his estate so well known, that the Tsar of Russia would often visit and hunt on his estate. When the Revolution of 1917 broke out, the White Army was initially successful in defeating the Red Army in the region near Rempel's estate. The officers of the White Army ordered their soldiers to put Red Army prisoners into boxcars and ship them off to Siberia. One evening, as Rempel and the White Army was sympathetic to these Mennonite farmers, let me just make that clear. One evening, as Rempel was walking home from the city with groceries he had purchased for his family, he came upon a railroad siding where there was a boxcar full of men. One of these captured soldiers called out to Rempel, "Sir, we're so hungry. We have been here all day with nothing to eat. Can you help us?" Acting on his Christian beliefs, Rempel walked over to the boxcar and began shoving his bread, cheeses, and sausages through the cracks. The man inside took them and passed them around. He said, "Thank you." And Aaron replied, "God bless you." Some months later, the tide of the struggle changed. The Red Army totally defeated the White Army, put their prisoners into boxcars, and shipped them to Siberia. Now we see a total reversal here. Within a few months, as the Marxists took over the country under Lenin's leadership, the Red Army rounded up all the Mennonite farmers in the area, put them into boxcars, and shipped them to Siberia as well. Deported to Siberia, Rempel went from a life of wealth to a life of poverty, from a position of strength to a position of weakness. And yet, he remained the entrepreneur he had always been. Recognizing the need for a warm drink in the Siberian cold, Rempel began shipping in tea from Mongolia and soon had a good business going. His neighbors, however, were envious of his success, and calling Rempel's business the crime of capitalism had him arrested by the Marxist authorities. As the trial progressed, it became evident that he was indeed guilty of capitalism. Finally, the commissar told him to step forward to be sentenced. Aaron Rempel stepped forward, fully expecting the sentence to mean his execution. But the commissar said, "I think we've met before." "No, Your Honor," Aaron replied, "we have never met." "Yes, I think we have. Were you ever in Nordenfeld?" Aaron said, "Why, yes, I lived there." "Do you remember an evening when a man called to you from a boxcar and said, 'We are so hungry. We have been in here all day with nothing to eat?'" "Yes," Aaron said, "I remember that." "And what did you do?" "Why, I went over to the boxcar and shoved my bread and cheeses and sausages through the slats." "And what did you say?" Aaron paused for a moment and then replied, "I think I said, 'God bless you.'" The commissar said, "Yes, we have met before. I was that man. I'm not going to sentence you. If you would like, I'll sign those papers for your family to emigrate." Aaron said, "Oh, thank you, sir. And would you sign those papers for all the Remples, for I have brothers here." All the Remples immigrated to Burbank, California. Interesting little story from history of a man that gave away what he had. I think he was, did it say he was, yes, this is groceries he had purchased for his family, and he gave them away. I was challenged with that. If I'm going to feed my family and somebody else calls out, I want to feed my family first, and then give, my tendency is to feed my family first and give you what's left over, if there's any. But this man gave it all that he had. Did his family go hungry that evening? We don't know. It's not said. That part of the story is not told. But yet, that bread that he cast out upon the waters, he had no anticipation of ever getting rewarded for it. In fact, he forgot all about it, apparently. But it came back. It came back to give him, to bless him in later years. 2 Corinthians 9, 6 and 7 says this: "He which soweth sparingly shall reap sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man according as he purposed in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth the cheerful giver." There's that verse I was looking for earlier, that cheerful or hilarious giver. The vanity of riches and the vanity of the pursuit of riches. Is that what we're living in? Are we pursuing riches in this world today? It will not bless us. And as Solomon said, it was a vexation of spirit to him. Now, obviously, there's bills to pay. I understand that. There's bills to pay. We do need to take care of those. But if wealth is our driving force, we have fallen into the very same trap that Solomon did. And as that tree falls, so shall it lie. God is sovereign, number three. I'll try to hasten on here. Why God does things, what God does and why he does them, I don't need to understand. Why Jeff Bezos has $113 billion and I have way, way, way less than that, I don't need to understand. Whether we live to 16, 40, 100, I don't need to understand. Whether we're wealthy or poor or wise or simple, I don't need to understand. Jared. Why God allows certain things to happen? Why did Karina Allgaier pass away when she appeared to be so needed? I don't need to understand. Well, all God asks of me is my obedience, not my understanding. If you love me, keep my commandments, Jesus said. When Dirk Willems turned back to help his pursuer, the man that was after him to capture him and take his life from him, or at least be instrumental in taking his life from him, when he fell through the ice and Dirk Willems turned back to help him, did he have any idea of what this act would cost him? Did he have any idea of the fact that 451 years later today, or not today, but 451 years later, this morning here, we're talking about him? Did he realize that? No, of course he didn't realize that. I think he probably realized he was likely giving up his life, but yet he did what was right, regardless of whether it was going to benefit himself or not. He didn't realize how God could use this to bless him. God forgot to bless his name through that. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. As the tree falleth, there it shall be. God is sovereign. God will bring events into our lives. God will change things in our lives. God will take people away from us. But fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And number four, very briefly, there is a path toward two destinations. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this point. I was going to more, but time won't allow. But there's a heaven and a hell. There's a place of judgment, and there's a place of blessing. There's a place of torment, and there's a place of bliss. Which one are you heading to this morning? By your life, which direction are you going? Are there things that are hindering you? Is there sin in your life that's keeping you on this path, and you're not willing to do what it takes to get on the path of blessing? Stop and consider your path, and stop and consider the end of your path. If you die today, both these two individuals I mentioned both died unexpectedly. Neither of them, of course, the one man, as I mentioned, was older, but yet he was, for all purposes, in good health. Went to bed, nobody knowing anything was a matter, and just never woke up. We do not know when our change will come. If you die today, where will you be? What happens when you cut a tree down? It's dead. You can stand it, try to stand it back up, and you can try to replant it, but it's dead. It's killed. It's over. That is a permanent change that has happened, that there's no reversing that. So is death. As the tree falleth, there it shall be. Someday it will be yours or my earthly body that's lying in the casket. Someday it will be yours or mine that's put in the ground. Someday it will be yours or my earthly body that the dirt is shoveled in on top of. As a tree falleth, there it shall be. Let's kneel for prayer.